This is our fourth study in the letter to the Hebrews. And the letter, of course, is called Hebrews because it's a letter to Hebrew people or Jewish people. These are Jews who've become Christians, and they're suffering much for it. They've faced intense persecution, which is something that's common for many followers of Jesus throughout the world even today. This past week, some of us got the persecution update from Frontline Missions. It summarized the situation in Nigeria. Situation in Nigeria right now looks like this. In 2019, more than 1,000 Christians were killed for their faith by terrorists. The Wall Street Journal wrote at the end of the year, "The massacre of Christians in Nigeria is horrific in brutality, and the world has hardly noticed it." On January 2nd, Pastor Lawan Ondimi was kidnapped by Boko Haram. He was executed on January 20th. That's 2 weeks ago. He left behind his wife and 8 children. The same frontline update urged us to pray for 16-year-old Leah Sharibu. She was abducted almost 2 years ago now with more than 100 girls from a technical school. A month later, this is March 2018, 104 girls were released. And as far as we know, Leah was the only one to be retained because, quote, she refused to comply with their demands and convert to Islam. Frontline reported, she has been promised release if she would simply recite the Islamic Shahada and wear a hijab. Yet, Leah has repeatedly refused to renounce her faith in Jesus. A U.S. government report says that Boko Haram's most recent threat is to keep Leah a slave for life. And Frontline, of course, is encouraging us to pray urgently for this young disciple, Leah. You see, intense opposition is common for many followers of Jesus throughout the world. The Hebrews to whom this letter was written were being persecuted. Many of them were under intense pressure to renounce Jesus. And the mindset, we have to put ourselves in the mindset of the people who were reading this letter, they were basically thinking is following Jesus worth it? Is it worth all this suffering? I mean, my life right now would be so much easier. It could be so much easier if I just stopped saying I'm a follower of Jesus. Knowing that this was the tendency of his Jewish readers, this author's main objective is to encourage endurance. Endurance through persecution with eyes fixed on Jesus. That's what I've titled this whole study in the letter to the Hebrews. He's saying, endure. Keep your eyes fixed on Jesus. Do not turn away from Jesus. You can hear him saying it to Leah. You can hear him saying it to Pastor Lawan and Demi throughout the couple weeks of his suffering. You can hear him saying it to these Jews who were suffering 2 millennia ago. What we read today in Hebrews 4:14 through 5:10 is actually concluding the author's introductory burden in the first 4 chapters of the book. And it's actually launching the heart of his burden, which is going to be sustained from chapters 5 to 10. The author has basically said in chapters 1 through 4, do not turn away from Jesus because he's the culmination of the entire Old Testament. And he basically says, if people under the Old Testament who rejected God's word then face such horrific consequences, like the Babylonian exile, the torching of Jerusalem. I mean, now that we've experienced what the Old Testament was pointing to, do you think there's going to be any less condemnation if we turn our backs on Jesus, God's climactic revelation of his glory and grace? I mean, if the consequences were bad then, what will happen now? And he goes on in chapters 3 and 4, like we studied last week, to basically say, I mean, if when people rejected God's promises given by Moses, if they failed to enter the promised land, what's going to happen if you turn your back on Jesus? He doesn't just give you access to a piece of real estate. Jesus is the one who can give you access to the eternal kingdom with God. He's saying, keep your eyes fixed on Jesus. Persevere, endure with your eyes fixed on Jesus. That's where he's been. Jesus is the culmination of the Old Testament. Where he's going to go for the next 5 to 6 chapters is he's going to start saying, Jesus is better than the Old Testament priesthood. And that's what we're going to read about. He's concluding the first section, beginning the next section. And we're going to discuss today just a little bit about the priesthood before we get to the two major applications in the passage. So, I'm going to read the passage again and then try to explain it as clearly as I can. Since then, we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens. That is Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession. Let's keep believing what we confess to believe. For we do not have a high priest who's unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted like we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to God's throne of grace so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in our time of need. For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, the ignorant and wayward people who come to him, because he, the priest, he himself is beset with weakness. Because of this, he's obligated to offer sacrifice for his own sins, just like he does for the sins of other people. And no one takes this honor, the position of priest, for himself, but only when he's called by God, just like Aaron was. Aaron was the father of Levi, and all of the priests in the Old Testament came from Levi. They were descendants of Aaron and Levi. They were called Levites. We actually have a whole book of the Bible, the things pertaining to the priests, and it's called Leviticus because they were all descendants of Aaron and Levi. So they didn't appoint themselves. They were appointed by God. Verse 5, in the same way, Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but he was appointed by God, the one who said to him in Psalm 2, you're my son. Today I've begotten you. I've appointed you. I've chosen you. Verse 6, and God also says in another place, he quotes Psalm 110, you, my chosen king, he's speaking to the Messiah, you are a priest forever after Melchizedek's order. In the days of his flesh, that means in his earthly life, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications, intense prayers with loud cries, even tears, to God who was able to save him from death. And Jesus was heard because of his reverence or because of his submissiveness. Jesus prayed, yet not my will, but yours be done in Gethsemane. Jesus submitted himself to suffering. Verse 8 then emphasizes, even though he was a son, he was the very Son of God. Even he learned obedience through what he suffered. It's really interesting. If you note, he learned, he suffered, those two words. The Greek words behind them, I don't typically quote Greek words, but you have to hear them because of the way they rhyme. It's emathen, aphon, epathen. He learned from that which he suffered. One commentator, Buist Fanning from Dallas Theological Seminary, says this is the 2,000-year-old Greek way of saying no pain, no gain. He's exactly right. He learned through what he suffered, and that's talking about Jesus. Verse 9, and being made perfect, or being perfectly qualified through all his suffering, Jesus became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him. Obey there has the idea of total life submission. All who submit their lives to Jesus because Jesus is designated by God a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. In that passage we just read, chapter 4, verse 14 through chapter 5, verse 10, the author gives two commands that are both rooted in one truth. Okay? There's two commands, two applications. They're rooted in one truth. And that fundamental truth is that Jesus is our great high priest. That's the way he's called in chapter 4, verse 14. And all the way through this passage, the fundamental truth is Jesus is our great high priest. Now, this might seem a little unusual to us. We might not immediately connect. Oh, yeah, Jesus is a high priest. Some of us might respond and be like, why is that significant? And why is he actually going to take so many chapters unpacking this central truth? A priest is basically a mediator, a go-between, a middleman between God and sinners. He stands between God and sinners, a bit like the way an attorney might stand between a defendant and the judge. The priest was someone who stood between sinners and God. Ever since Adam chose to rebel in the garden and people were expelled from the place where God made his presence known, the entire Bible has been the story of how God is making a way back into his presence. The whole story of the Bible is about how people can be right with God. And the reality is, if you read the Old Testament, here's just a simple thematic way of describing how people approach God. Throughout the Old Testament, God taught people that the only way he could be approached was through a temple that he designed, through an animal sacrifice that he required. That sacrifice would take place in that temple, on that temple property. And that animal sacrifice had to be offered by a priest whom God had appointed. We're talking the entire Old Testament history. If you wanted to meet with God, this was the protocol. You go to that temple and you ask a priest to offer that sacrifice on your behalf, and it is the only way that sinners can approach a holy God. This was especially evident on the greatest holiday of the Hebrew calendar, called the Day of Atonement, or Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur was the day, the one day of the year, that the high priest would actually enter into the temple's cubicle inner room called the Holy of Holies, the most holy place. And there, over the Ark of the Covenant, on the mercy seat, which symbolized the throne of God, the priest would offer two sacrifices. He would kill a bull, pour its blood over that seat for his own sins. And then he would take a goat and take its life, and he would spill the blood of that goat over the mercy seat for the sins of the entire nation that was gathered there. This was the way God prescribed for people to meet with him. If you want to enjoy the presence of God, if you want to have a relationship with God, it's the only way until Jesus comes. The temple, the priests, and the sacrifices were all elaborate, vivid pictures. They were object lessons, and they were all pointing us to Jesus, helping us to understand who Jesus was and what he would do when he finally came. The temple taught people that God is holy. He is set apart from sin. You don't just run into the presence of God. There's distance. There's separation from sinners. And the only way you can access the presence of God is to come to that temple and come on his terms. Now, of course, the day Jesus died, the curtain of that most holy room was torn in two from top to bottom, and it symbolized that now sinners could approach God not through the temple, but through Jesus. The temple was just foreshadowing Jesus. Similarly, the sacrifices kept teaching people that sin results in death. First page of the Bible, if you sin, you will die. Sin results in death, and the only way a human can escape the penalty for his or her sin is by the death of a substitute. God was teaching it over and over, thousands of times, millions of times. If you're going to be forgiven of sin, cleansed of sin, cleared of your guilt, it's going to be through the death of a substitute. Sin brings death, and you can be forgiven through the death of a substitute. Now again, the animal sacrifices themselves could never cleanse sin, right? These are animals, and the sinners are humans. No chance that that animal blood is actually paying for human sin. And yet they were profound, repeated object lessons saying, you need a perfect substitute. And when Jesus, the Lamb of God, the sacrifice provided by God, when Jesus offered himself on the cross, he was the once-for-all sacrifice. Once Jesus died, no more sacrifices need to be made. Jesus is the once-for-all sacrifice. All of the sacrifices that took place in the temple throughout the Old Testament were pointing ahead to him. And then lastly, and this is the subject in front of us, the priests. The priests continually taught people that the only way you can approach God is through a mediator, through a representative, a go-between, a designated person who could represent both God and the sinner. But again, every one of these human priests was just an object lesson teaching us what Jesus was going to be like, what Jesus was going to do. They were pointing ahead to the perfect priest who was truly the God-man. He was fully God and fully man, and so he could truly mediate, act as a priest between God and men. And once Jesus, God's Son and the only mediator, has become human and offered himself for sinners on the cross, there is no more need for a temple. There's no more need for animal sacrifices, and there is no more need for human priests. Not even, let me add, in a Christian church. It is blasphemous to Jesus to call anyone a priest today. Jesus is our great high priest. And once he has done his priestly work and taken his seat in heaven, Jesus is the only priest we need. Now, with that foundation, we've got to go back to the text. Jesus is our great high priest. The last couple verses of chapter 4, verses 14 through 16, describe Jesus as our great high priest. It says he has risen and exalted. He's taken his seat at the Father's right hand. And because he is fully God, the Son of God, become Jesus, the historical Jesus, he can represent us in the presence of God, and he can fully sympathize with every human in our weaknesses. Then, in the first 10 verses of chapter 5, there are two comparisons made. The comparisons are between all the Old Testament priests and Jesus, the great high priest. They're between Aaron's sons, Aaron's descendants through Levi in verses 1 through 4, and Jesus in verses 5 to 10. Jesus, just like the Old Testament priest, was appointed by God. And Jesus, just like the Old Testament priest, was compassionate toward the people he represented. So he was appointed by God, and he was compassionate toward the people he represented. This is significant because in each case, the writer is saying, Jesus is better. And of course, if he's speaking to Jewish Christians who are thinking, is it really worth it following Jesus? Implicit in what he's saying is, don't go back and worship at the temple. Don't think that the animal sacrifices there, offered by the priests there, can do anything to help. Not if you know who Jesus is. You've got to keep following Jesus. Endure with eyes fixed on Jesus. So he says first The Messiah, just like all the other priests, was appointed by God. Every priest must be appointed or designated by God. Here, Jesus is better, because the quotations in from the Psalms in verses 5 and 6, do you see those again? Chapter 5, verses 5 and 6, he quotes Psalm 2 and Psalm 110. One identifies Jesus as God's chosen king, the Messiah, and the other, Psalm 110, identifies him as priest forever, the Messiah's priest forever. Jesus is God the Son, chosen to be king on earth, and that king on earth, Jesus, is the priest forever, God's chosen priest forever. He's better because every one of the Levitical priests served for their generation. They may have served for a couple decades until someone else had to take their place. Jesus, according to Psalm 110, is God's priest forever, the ultimate priest, and he's the one who can represent everyone who follows him before God. The second issue is not appointment, but the ability to be compassionate toward the people he represents, and this is huge for people who are suffering. The priests, according to verse 1 and 2, had to be one of the people so that they could represent the people with compassion, with understanding. And here, too, Jesus is shown to be better than any priest who came before him, because Jesus suffered intensely as a human, but he never sinned. So Jesus was much better than Aaron's sons. You see, if you would have gone and sought relationship with God through the mediation of one of the Aaronic priests, they would have had to deal gently with you because they were made of the same stuff. They were sinners just like you. They could have said, "I understand what it is to be a sinner." Jesus can come to us and he can say, "I understand what it is to be tempted. I understand what it is to be weak. I understand what it is to suffer." But Jesus can go a step farther, and he can say, "I can actually deal with your sin because I never sinned." Jesus can say, "I can act not just identify with you in your problem, I can get you out." Jesus has the ability to come to us and say, "I understand what it is to suffer, and I can help you out of it. I have cleared the path. I have suffered for sin. I have experienced death, and I can lead you all the way to resurrection life in the kingdom forever." Jesus has much greater power than any priest who came before him. He can have compassion on us, and he can truly, as chapter 4, verse 16 emphasizes, he can truly help. So with that as the foundation, Jesus is our great high priest. Now we can understand and feel the force of the two commands that are given. One is given in chapter 4, verse 14, and the other in chapter 4, verse 16. In chapter 4, verse 14, the writer says, "Let us hold fast our confession," our commitment to believing Jesus and following him. And in verse 16, he says, "Let us with confidence draw near to God for all the help we need." Let us keep holding to what we believe. Let us with confidence draw near to God for the help we need. In other words, just keep believing what you say you believe and keep boldly going to God for the help you need in your suffering. I word the main point, I word it like this. Keep enduring in your commitment to Jesus and keep confidently approaching God for help, because Jesus can truly help. He's the mediator who can truly help you. Despite the suffering you're experiencing, keep on enduring in your commitment to Jesus. And keep on confidently approaching God for help, because he is your priest. He's your unique mediator. He's the one and only person who can actually represent you before God. And so he can truly help you. He can really actually help you. I'm going to apply this in two different ways, and then we observe the Lord's Supper together. You see the words, the last words of chapter 4? You'll find grace to help in time of need. Help in time of need. What are the worst kinds of need that Christians can find ourselves in? And what kinds of help might we need from God in those times? I think the author has two of the worst needs Christians find ourselves in view. One of them is in view in verse 15 of chapter 4. The other's in view in chapter 5, verses 7 and 8. I just want to zero in on these two really intense, difficult seasons of need. The first one is this. Have you fallen to temptation? What happens to you when your life is full of pressure? In those weeks when you're saying, if it's raining, it's pouring. Many times, Christians who are under pressure fall to temptation. They cave to temptation. Many times we excuse it. My life has just gotten so hard. I had to look for the quick pleasure fix. It might be the quick fix of food or alcohol. It might be the quick pleasure fix of immoral desire. It might be the quick fix of just letting your feelings control you so that you excuse an attitude of moping or of irritability all day long or all week long or all season long. There is nothing worse for Christians when your life is hard to then compound it with failure to sinful choices. Is that where some of you in here find yourself today? Your life is so hard, and when you think about it, you think, I can't even like look up. Because when I think about the real me, I'm disgusted. It's like if my life couldn't have gotten any worse, it just did. That's the kind of need that the author has in view when he talks about verse 15. He has in view teenagers who've just caved into the worldly pressures of their friends, who are always saying, laugh at the things we laugh at, talk about the things we talk about, live like we live. And you just say, following Jesus is so hard. And you finally just say, I'm just going to give in. I'm going to be like them. It would make my life a whole lot easier. I'd be so much more accepted. And now you sit here this morning and you're like, I can't go to God right now. I've got to clean myself up. The writer says, if you find yourself in this situation where you have fallen to temptation, you have caved in under pressure in a moment of weakness, he says, go to God boldly for the help you need. The author actually says that if you understand that Jesus is your high priest, you can go to God boldly. Because Jesus, your high priest, understands what it is to be weak. He understands what it is to be under pressure. And he died for your sins. And he right now represents you before God with compassion. And if you go boldly to him right now, you will find mercy. You will find grace. Don't let your failure to temptation keep you from God. Acknowledge it right now and go boldly to God in this time of need. Jesus faced unimaginable temptation when he was at his weakest. We read about his temptations in the wilderness. Do you realize that your high priest, who's standing right there for you before God, he can truly sympathize with you in your weaknesses? He knows what it is to experience pressure. He knows what it is to be weak, but Jesus can also help. He can help you. Jesus gave himself as the offering for your sin, and then he rose again. That's your mediator. He completely atoned for your sin. So just go to God boldly. Say, cleanse me, forgive me. Jesus stands there before you, God, and I have no other hope but him. And you're going to find grace to help in your time of need. I think it's crucial to clarify that the kind of help that Jesus gives is not what would be called today therapeutic help. You know, if you go to a counselor, they might listen for a long time, and it could be helpful for someone to listen and give another perspective. But many times, the goal of a therapeutic counseling session is to help you get a broader perspective on your problems and to think about it from different angles and to help you understand that you're not alone and you go out and you're supposed to feel better. This is not the kind of help that Jesus provides. The kind of help that Jesus provides those who fall into temptation is he provides grace to forgive. He can actually cleanse your sin, deal with it before God so that you never face it again. That's the real help you need. It's not just turning things in your mind, looking at things from a different perspective. This is real help. He can actually clear your real guilt. Second issue, are you facing death? This is the issue that's in view in chapter 5, verses 7 and 8. We have several people in this room who are either facing death yourself or you have an immediate family member who is. You're living with the cold reality of death staring you in the face. So when you read that last phrase of chapter 4, grace to help in time of need, your time of need sounds like, God, I don't want to die. God, I do not want my loved one to die. And some of us in here find ourselves in this need today. Where do you find help? Where do you find help? The answer is the same. If you're facing death, you boldly go to God because Jesus is your mediator. He's right now, right there at God's right hand. He is the only mediator who has actually faced death and is alive again to help those who face it. The author says, actually, chapter 5 or 7, look back at it again. When Jesus faced death, he did so with prayers, supplications, loud cries, tears. And it is ironic that there in Gethsemane, the night before he was crucified, Jesus was praying to, it says, the God who was able to save him from death. But the God who was able to save him from death didn't save him from death immediately. It was the will of the Father that Jesus would die. And Jesus submitted himself to God, praying, not my will, yours be done. If you're facing death, go to God. Not timidly, but boldly. Because Jesus is your mediator there at God's right hand. Again, this isn't the therapeutic kind of help that helps you think differently about things. Jesus is the one who actually conquered death. So if you're facing death, he can really help you. He can actually rescue you in a way that will last forever. You see that? Verse 9, Jesus through suffering has become the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. That's real help. This, of course, I pointed out in the reading when it says he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. You might underline the word obey, and you might use an alternate term like submit, all who submit to him. This is not talking about did you obey good enough today and will you obey good enough tomorrow and will your good works outweigh your bad. It's not talking about that kind of obedience at all. Instead, it's talking about definitive submission. Have you submitted your life to Jesus? Asked in different ways or spoken of in different ways all throughout the Bible. Are you a follower of Jesus? Is Jesus your Lord? Have you submitted your life to him? Do you obey him? These are all different ways of saying the same thing. If you have not obeyed Jesus, submitted your life to Jesus, fallen before him and said, "Be my Savior and Lord," if you have not, I urge you, embrace him today, submit your life to him today, and he will be the source of eternal salvation to you. You see that, verse 9? You will have found the source of eternal salvation. If you have submitted your life to Jesus, then approach God with boldness in your time of need. Jesus died for sin, and then he beat death. So he's the one and only priest who can really help you in your times of darkest need.